A fourth grader talks about watching her friends and teachers murdered. A mother describes the shrapnel that will be in her son's body for life. A doctor recounts the kinds of wounds once seen only on battlefields, but are now inflicted in movie theaters, synagogues, supermarkets, and most recently, fourth grade classrooms. John Berman here, in for Anderson. Today, members of the House Oversight Committee heard from people whose lives were touched and changed forever by the mass shootings in Buffalo and Uvalde. Their testimony came with lawmakers in both chambers debating gun legislation. But before getting to where it all stands tonight, I want you to hear from these witnesses, starting with Mia Cirillo, 11 years old, talking about the moment the gunman came into her fourth grade classroom at Robb Elementary School, and her teacher tried her best to keep everyone safe. We do want to warn you that it's graphic and difficult to hear, but it's important to hear it unfiltered, because no matter where you stand on the issue of guns, this shouldn't be happening.
We were just watching the movie, and then she got an email, and then she went to go lock the door, and he was in the hallway, and they made eye contact, and then she went to back in the room to show us, go hide, and then we went to go hide behind my teacher's desk and behind the backpacks, and then he shot the little window, and then he went to the other classroom, and then he went, there's a door between our classrooms, and he went to there and shot my teacher and told my teacher goodnight and shot her in the head. And then he shot some of my classmates and the whiteboard. When I went to the backpacks, he shot my friend that was next to me. And I thought he was gonna come back to the room. So I grabbed the blood and I put it all over me.
Do you feel safe at school? Why not?
Because I don't want it to happen again.
And you think it's gonna happen again?
What I did find was something no prayer will ever relieve. Two children whose bodies had been pulverized by bullets fired at them, decapitated, whose flesh had been ripped apart, that the only clue at their identities was a blood-splattered cartoon clothes still clinging to them, clinging for life and finding none.
To the lawmakers who feel that we do not need stricter gun laws, let me paint a picture for you. My son, Zaire, has a hole in the right side of his neck, two on his back, and another on his left leg. Caused by an exploding bullet from an AR-15. As I clean his wounds, I can feel pieces of that bullet in his back. Shrapnel will be left inside of his body for the rest of his life. Now I want you to picture that exact scenario for one of your children. This should not be your story or mine.
Somewhere out there, there is a mom listening to our testimony, thinking, I can't even imagine their pain. Not knowing that our reality will one day be hers, unless we act now.
I chose to be a pediatrician. I chose to take care of children. Keeping them safe from preventable diseases, I can do. Keeping them safe from bacteria and brittle bones, I can do. But making sure our children are safe from guns, that's the job of our politicians and leaders. In this case, you are the doctors, and our country is the patient. We are lying on the operating table, riddled with bullets like the children of Robb Elementary and so many other schools. We are bleeding out and you are not there. My oath as a doctor means that I signed up to save lives. I do my job. And I guess it turns out that I am here to plead, to beg, to please, please do yours.
That was Dr. Roy Guerrero earlier today, and he joins us now. Dr. Guerrero, your testimony was incredibly powerful, it was important, and it must have been difficult for you. What was going through your mind today in those moments?
I think the biggest thing that was going through my mind was that deciding how much of the truth I wanted to expose and to say. But I felt it was important because only by painting that visual image could you actually get people to understand the gravity of what happened to our community and to understand how much my community is suffering and how much we're just completely devastated and still hurting 2 weeks after this happened.
How much of the truth to share, you say? What is the truth?
That these weapons of war cause wounds that are war wounds, the things you see on movies, things that no pediatrician, much less any doctor, is ever ready to see. We were forced into this situation by someone that was out to murder children, and the wounds were exactly as I described.
You concluded your testimony by pleading with the politicians and leaders to do their jobs. Now, I know physicians aren't political figures, but they're right. concerned about the welfare of their patients. You know, what would you like to see happen?
At the very least, I don't like to use the word gun control or gun reform. Just implementing safety that these guns can't get in the hands of people that shouldn't have them, that, you know, these people should have background checks, especially if they suffer from mental illness or any other kind of emotional trauma or problems. You get diagnoses run on you whenever you're trying to buy life insurance. So why not whenever you're trying to buy any type of gun? I think that's a start. And I think at least knowing that the person that's going to buy or purchase these weapons doesn't have some kind of mental issue that could cause them to perform any more of these horrendous acts would be a good place to start.
You spoke about seeing Mia Cirillo at the hospital mm-hmm. the day of the shooting. She bravely gave her testimony at this hearing today. You've known her since she was a baby. Yeah. Can you just tell us about that moment that you saw her and her parents shortly after the shooting?
Yeah, so as I was called to the hospital, as I noted in my testimony today, Mia was one of the first of my patients that I saw as I walked in to the ER. She was bleeding. She was obviously in shock and crying, and she had a bleeding shoulder, and you could tell what were shrapnel wounds all over her body, and you know, she had blood everywhere. And her first question is, "Have you seen my mom?" And like I said, I've known Mia since she was probably a couple of months old, and so I immediately told her, "Yeah, I think I just saw your mom outside as I walked in." And so as I walked out, I did locate Mia's parents and let them know that she was okay. But it was horrifying to see a child that's basically like yours, because you've known them for so long, be in that situation and have these kinds of injuries. So
you say you'll never forget what you saw that day. You know, you speak about the mother's cries that you'll never get out of your head, and the fact that the only clue to the identities of the children was the blood-spattered cartoon clothes they were wearing. Do you think it's mm-hmm. possible for people across the country to fully grasp the horror of what you saw?
No. I think unless you lived it and you felt it and you still feel it like the community does today, and how Uvalde is mourning still at this point, you'll never truly know or feel what we felt. But at least if I can at least paint a mental picture of these horrendous acts that shouldn't be happening, I think that's a start, because, like I said, no one should ever experience this.
And it's back to that initial point you made, how much of the truth you want to share with people. What do people need to know? What do people need to know about the sites that you saw? And again, I know it's hard for people to hear, mm-hmm. but you obviously think it's important that they do.
Yeah. I just think that people need to know that these type of guns, assault weapons, AR-15s, have no place in our society, merely because of the type of injuries and wounds that they cause. And as you mentioned, you know, with these types of scenarios and with the things that we saw that day, I'm not going to repeat what the injuries were. The reports are out there. Everyone's read it. Everyone's seen my testimony. That's something that no family or no community should ever relive ever again.
And I know you're a pediatrician. You've treated patients mm-hmm. and you've probably treated all kinds of things in your life. But I know you've also never seen anything like this.
No.
How are you doing? How is your community doing tonight?
We're struggling. We're broken. Mm-hmm. Uvalde will never be the same. I think, speaking for myself, you know, it's 2 weeks from mm-hmm. from the tragedy, and here I am speaking to you. Here I am at the U.S. Capitol when, you know, a month ago I was, you know, treating the normal ailments of a pediatrician's normal daily tasks. I never thought I would be sitting here with you right now. I really think I really haven't dealt with the full impact of what's happened to me, what's happened to my community, which is today we actually had a meeting on Capitol Hill with some policymakers just speaking of the counseling and the psychology help we're going to need for the community, the parents, aunts, uncles, friends, even myself, weeks to months to years from now after this tragedy.
Dr. Ruggiero, I know the community is grateful for the work you're doing. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Texas Senator John Cornyn, the lead Republican negotiator, told CNN tonight that he managed to see some of the House testimony when about the demand by some witnesses to do more than what's being proposed in the Senate talks. Senator Cornyn said he understands their concerns, says his goal is saving lives, but added, nobody knows exactly what we're going to do, including me. For more on what's happening on the Senate and the House side, we're joined tonight by CNN's Lauren Fox. Lauren, what's the latest on the gun safety measures being voted on in the House, and what's the outlook for action in the Senate?
Yeah, John, just moments ago, the House passing their own gun legislation, the Protecting Our Kids Act, which includes several provisions that are not going to be included in those Senate negotiations. One of them that got several Republican votes was a increase in the age at which you could buy an AR-15 from the age of 18 to 21. They voted individually on all of these measures before voting on the overall package, and 10 Republicans voted on that measure when it came to the House floor. There's also legislation included in this broader package in the House that would limit the size of high-capacity magazines, another provision that is not going to be part of these Senate negotiations. But like you said, the House making it very clear where they stand, of course, controlled by Democrats, versus the Senate, where those bipartisan talks are going more slowly and more deliberately, perhaps, but where it is certainly going to be much harder to get the sweeping kinds of reforms that you had parents begging, pleading with lawmakers to pass today in that oversight hearing.
I mentioned Senator Cornyn said he saw some of the clips of the testimony today. Is it clear whether the testimony in the House had much of an impact on the Senate negotiations?
Well, I was talking to several members about whether they actually watched pieces of that hearing, whether they saw clips. It was interesting, the juxtaposition. Senator Cornyn said he did see some clips. Senator Ted Cruz said he had been in committee hearings all day and had not seen them. They, of course, both represent the state of Texas. Right now, it doesn't seem, given what Cornyn said about he doesn't even know what's going to be in the Senate package, that this has had an impact in how they are negotiating. Again, the things that the parents are asking for are not going to be included in that broader Senate package. Instead, the senators are looking at much more narrow provisions, things like including juvenile records in the background checks of people who go and try to buy an AR-15 if they're between the ages of 18 and 21. They're also looking at about $7 billion for mental health funding. But those items are just not going to reach as far as something like banning assault weapons or banning the kind of weapons that did the kind of damage to children that the pediatrician was just talking about.
Lauren John? Fox, thank you very much. One other related item, Attorney General Merrick Garland announced today that the Justice Department will review the actions law enforcement took and did not take at Robb Elementary. Uvalde's mayor requested the probe. So just last night, we reported a new bulletin from the Homeland Security Department. It warned of a possible uptick in violence fueled by, among other things, the upcoming Supreme Court ruling on abortion. Well, not long after we left you, in the early hours of the morning, the possible became the actual. And now a man is in custody, charged with trying to murder a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. CNN's Jessica Snyder joins us with all we know about the alleged attempt on Brett Kavanaugh. Jessica, what are authorities saying about what happened, who this would-be assassin is, what he was planning to do, and his motivation?
Yeah, John, so this is a 26-year-old man from Simi Valley, California. He is now in federal custody, but authorities say he traveled across the country with the express intent to break into a Supreme Court justice's home and kill him. And now we know that the intended target was Justice Brett Kavanaugh. So this all unfolded outside the justice's home, just outside of D.C. in Maryland overnight. Authorities say the suspect showed up. He was dressed all in black. He was carrying a suitcase and a backpack. Those were were filled with weapons and ammunition, John. It included a Glock 17 pistol with two magazines, ammunition, also zip ties, a hammer, even a crowbar. Now, officials say that shortly thereafter, when he got out of the cab, he actually called 911 on himself, and he told the dispatcher that he was suicidal, that he also had a gun. That's when police moved in. They arrested him. And then when FBI agents questioned him, that 26-year-old said that he had numerous reasons for being there. He said he was upset about the leaked draft of that Roe v. Wade opinion that has not been officially released yet. Also said he was angered about the mass shooting in Uvalde, and then said that he was concerned that Justice Brett Kavanaugh would cast a vote to strike down a New York gun law. We're also still waiting on that opinion. And John, perhaps most strikingly, is that this suspect allegedly told authorities that he bought the pistol and the ammunition with the express intent to kill, traveling cross-country in what was this plot. John?
Do we know if Justice Kavanaugh was home at the time of the incident, or if security alerted his family?
So here's the thing. The Supreme Court has been very tight-lipped about the whereabouts of any of the justices in the past few weeks since that leak. They haven't even been telling us about the Supreme Court justices' public appearances. So we don't know if Justice Kavanaugh was home, but we know he lives there with his wife, his two young daughters. Notably, though, John, a few weeks ago, the Attorney General said that U.S. Marshals would provide around-the-clock security for the justices and their families. So the Marshals were there outside his home. They also saw the suspect arrived and sort of helped thwart this plot.
All right, Jessica Snyder, stick around for a second. I want to bring in CNN Chief Legal Analyst Jeffrey Toobin. Jeffrey, look, we saw the Homeland Security warning. Still, though, I mean, how surprising is this for you to see?
Well, unfortunately, it's not that surprising because of the, you know, incredibly tense and violent atmosphere that we see in so much now. I mean, you know, look at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is surrounded by this enormous, ugly fence for security reasons. And this is just an incredibly scary, awful story about the threat to Justice Kavanaugh. I mean, this guy had real guns with him. And, you know, maybe he was mentally ill, maybe he wasn't. We don't know all the circumstances. But the fact is, this was a real threat, it appears. And we can only be fortunate that it didn't get any farther than it did.
Is there any historical precedent for this, Jeffrey, that a security bulletin is issued around a pending Supreme Court decision?
Well, certainly not in the modern era of the Supreme Court. You know, not too long ago, Supreme Court justices traveled the world like members of Congress with very little or no security at all. I mean, they have always been public figures, but they were not the people subject to threats. Those days are over, and they are getting more over all the time. The security is ramping up. Obviously, the Bush v. Gore, the Roe v. Wade case, the case that may overturn abortion rights in America, is something that has raised sensitivity and provoked a great deal of anger. So. You know, unfortunately, the threat level is probably only going to rise as we get closer to that decision, probably by the end of June.
Jessica, what does the federal case look like against this individual, and what kind of prison time could he be facing?
This is serious. This is a serious charge. It's attempted murder of a U.S. judge. It carries up to 20 years in prison. We saw the suspect. He was in court today in federal court in Maryland before a magistrate judge. He was remanded, so he will be locked up until his next court date, which is later in June. But this is a very serious charge. I mean, attempted murder of a U.S. judge, 20 years.
Serious charge for what could have been a very serious incident. Jessica Snyder, Jeffrey Toobin, thanks to you both. Next, one of the police heroes of January 6th and what he would like to see from the televised hearings, which begin tomorrow. Also, new audio of the top House Republican on January 11th endorsing the very same goals of the Select Committee and investigation that he now opposes. Later, new details in the strange disappearance of Caitlin Armstrong, who vanished shortly after police issued a warrant for her arrest, and the killing of pro-cyclist Anna Maria Wilson, where federal investigators say she was spotted. With the televised House January 6th hearings now less than a day away, there is new audio tonight of one of the Republican leaders who was refusing to cooperate with the investigation. It was just released by reporters Alex Burns and Jonathan Martin in connection with their new book, This Will Not Pass. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy talking to members on January 11th, just days after the attack on the Capitol, essentially agreeing with everything the committee he now opposes says it stands for.
We cannot just sweep this under the rug. We need to know why it happened, who did it, and people need to be held accountable for it. And I'm committed to make sure that happens.
So just days after he said that, he went to Mar-a-Lago, made nice with the former president, and is now leading the opposition to everything pretty much he said he was for back on January 11th. Also in these new tapes, audio of a Republican congressman from Indiana on January 5th telling colleagues he doesn't like the fact that he's about to vote to overturn election results, but is doing it anyway because his constituents are demanding it.
The reality is this is a political vote for many of us. I'm going to vote my district. My district wants me to object to the states that get bicameral objections. And that's how I'm going to vote. Do I like it? No.
Joining us now, CNN law enforcement analyst Michael Fanone. He was beaten, tasered, and suffered traumatic brain injury and later a heart attack defending the Capitol from the very mob that the election big lie incited. Officer Fanone, thank you so much for being with us. You hear those comments from Republican lawmakers before and after the insurrection, particularly Kevin McCarthy, who is now against the select committee. So when you hear that now, how does it make you feel?
Well, I mean, I agreed with the Kevin McCarthy that, you know, uttered those words. I think it was on January 11th. Obviously, you know, I've talked about it many times. He's reversed course and made the events of that day purely political. You know, he's looking for looking at his own political future, the future of his party. Those are the things that appear to be most important to Kevin McCarthy.
I just want to play a little bit more of what was said the day before the attack. And this time it's by Republican Congresswoman Debbie Lesko of Arizona. Listen to this.
I also asked leadership to come up with a safety plan for members. I'm actually very concerned about this because we have who knows how many hundreds of thousands of people coming here. We have Antifa. We also have, quite honestly, Trump supporters who actually believe that we are going to overturn the election. And when that doesn't happen, most likely will not happen, they are going to go nuts.
This is January 5th. Debbie Lesko saying there will be Trump supporters there who are going to go nuts. So hearing that now, having gone through everything you did, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't understand it, to be totally honest with you. I don't know what to think. You know, this was obviously an incredibly violent day. Many officers were injured. People lost their lives, including a police officer. And, you know, that aside, it was the most, to me at least, the most embarrassing moment in my lifetime for our country on the national and also on the international stage. I mean, we've become, you know, a parody of ourselves. Or the laughing stock, you know, America that touts the peaceful transition of power and lectures other countries. You know, look what we've become.
So these hearings begin tomorrow night in prime time. What are the outstanding questions that you have that need to be answered? What are the blanks that you want to have filled in?
Yeah, I have the same questions that I had when I testified last year. I want to know that if there were elected members of our government or government officials who participated in an overt effort to overturn the 2020 election. I want to know about our elected members and their subordinates' internal conversations and whether or not they reflect their public rhetoric. I want to know if their subordinates coordinated with the individuals who carried out the violent attack, or if elected members, for that matter, coordinated with these individuals, these groups, three percenters, the Proud Boys, et cetera. I also want some answers with regards to the physical security of the Capitol. Now, I'm not a police officer anymore. I know I'm not privy to certain types of information, but I think the U.S. Capitol Police owes it not only to their own officers, but also to the other agencies that responded that day to assist. There should be some assurances that steps have been taken to assure that the events of that day won't happen again. You know, whether it's physical security, training, preparation, regardless. I mean, there were some catastrophic failures in preparation and leadership within the United States Capitol Police. And as far as I know, the only person that lost their job was Chief Sun. And I think that's pretty outrageous, if you ask me.
Are you worried about possible misinformation that will be floated in the coming weeks around the hearing? I mean, just tonight, Congressman Troy Neils, who House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy originally wanted on the committee, told Armelli Zenota that, quote, "I think the Capitol Police didn't have the National Guard here because maybe they just wanted it to happen."
Yeah, I mean, I try not to speak specifically to the conspiracy theories. I mean, unfortunately, we've got too many members of the, you know, tinfoil hat brigade that have infiltrated our government. You know, if the congressman has evidence of that, why hasn't he brought that forward? You know, it's that type of dangerous rhetoric, you know, insinuating things like that with no evidence that got us here in the first place.
Michael Fanone, I do appreciate your time tonight. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Up next, the message sent to Democrats nationwide after California voters went to the polls. The results in some key races, including the Los Angeles mayoral race, are getting a lot of attention. We're going to talk it over with Democratic strategist James Carville. A powerful message for Democrats nationwide when you look at some of the primary results in California, one of the most liberal states and home to two of the most liberal cities in the country. Voters sent a message: address crime and homelessness. Voters recalled San Francisco District Attorney Chase Boudin by a 20-point margin. Not much support for his progressive policies on crime and prison reform in a city that has faced a plague of burglary and public disorder. And in the Los Angeles mayoral race, billionaire businessman and Republican turned Democrat Rick Caruso, who promises a tough on crime approach, got enough support to force a November runoff against longtime Democratic Congresswoman Karen Bass. Joining us now for his take on the Democratic results is strategist James Carville, co-host of the Politics War Room podcast. James, thank you for being with us. How much of a wake-up call should this be for national Democrats?
Well, Democratic voters have seized control of their party. The people of San Francisco won last night. The faculty at Berkeley, the University of California at Berkeley, lost. And, you know, this is not unusual. They lost in Seattle, Minneapolis, Buffalo, Cleveland, New Orleans, New York City. I mean, hopefully that a lot of people in the party and a lot of people that cover the party and influencers understand that the Democrats around the country live in this country, and they want a safe country, and they want people to pay attention to them, the people that do the work and walk the streets and ride mass transit and go to the hospitals and send their kids to school. That's who counts in this country, not a bunch of snobby, self-righteous elites.
Back in May of last year, we're talking about a year ago, you wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. You warned Democrats that they need to face crime head on. And you concluded with the quote, "Democrats don't pivot on crime. Own the issue, or the issue will own you." Is crime owning Democrats right now?
Well, it's owning a certain sliver of the Democratic Party. And, you know, a blind acorn finds a squirrel every now and then. I look back on that piece and, you know, this blind squirrel found an acorn, but I could feel it and you could see it coming. And we had a very successful, you know, President Biden and President Clinton in 1994 authored and passed an assault weapons ban. It was in place for 10 years. And then they repealed it. We had 400,000 assault weapons in this country in 1994. We now have 20 million. the violent crime rate in the United States dropped precipitously between 1994 and 2019. It was only in the last year of President Trump that the crime rate skyrocketed. And I just don't understand why some Democrats run away from this issue, because the Democratic voters are not running away from this issue because they feel it. I feel it here in New Orleans. I talk to people on the street that feel it. And this should be our issue. It really should.
How much of the struggle do you trace back to the perception, fair or unfair, that your party embraced the defund the police mantra? I know it wasn't the leaders. I know it's not Joe Biden. He, from the beginning, has been against it. But how much of a problem has that been for the party?
It's been a terrible problem. And defund the police is what we call in our business is sticky. Okay, think of it's the economy, stupid. That's sticky. I think it's probably sticky in a good way, but it's sticky. And defund the police is sticky in a bad way. And you had a lot of the commentariat was saying this is a new move in America. This is that. Of course, they put it on the ballot in Minneapolis, and it went down terribly. And it particularly went down in more marginal neighborhoods because people feel this. And it's not too much for an American taxpayer, an American voter, to ask for humane, effective policing. The two are not exclusionary. And until Democrats understand that, we're going to continue to have these setbacks. But actually, the Democrats have a much, much better record on crime than the Republicans do. And for some reason, we seem to be afraid to run of it. But there is no reason to do that. And you look at this sickening stuff with these assault weapons, it was one of the great Democratic successes ever.
James Carville, we do appreciate your time tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, John. You bet. Appreciate it.
Up next, as Russia continues to advance in eastern Ukraine, we'll take you to the Ukrainian front lines, where troops say powerful American weaponry is giving them an edge against Russian forces. A CNN exclusive now on sophisticated American weapons being supplied to Ukraine. We've been hearing about them for weeks now as each new shipment is announced. Now, for the first time, we see them in action on the front lines. More from CNN's Matthew Chance.
These are just some of the powerful American guns now on the Ukrainian front lines, meant to make a critical difference in the war with Russia. Of course, they might be targeted at any moment. Media access to them is highly sensitive and rare.
All right, well, we've been taken here very close to the front lines in southern Ukraine, where we're being shown these US-provided long-range artillery systems. It's an M777. According to Ukrainian military officials that we've spoken to, the US has so far supplied approximately 90 of these weapons, and many of them are already being used on the front line, including in this area here in the south of Ukraine, pounding Russian positions.
We were only shown a training exercise, but Ukrainian military officials say these are exclusive images of the same weapons in action just this week, firing on Russian forces more than 20 miles away. Including on this Grad multiple rocket launcher, they say had been targeting civilian areas. Ukrainian aerial footage shows the Grad being destroyed, its ammunition exploding after a direct hit. Ukrainian artillery troops say their guns are now giving them an edge, and their Russian counterparts are feeling the pain.
Yes, they definitely notice as we became faster and more precise. They are not able to keep up with us as they are operating old Soviet guns, which are heavier, less precise, slower, and difficult to use. These guns are objectively the best in the world, and when we started using them, our efficiency rose tremendously.
It's giving the Ukrainian military an advantage, they say, on the battlefield, because these weapons are much lighter, much more accurate than they've used before, much more mobile as well. And it's giving them the edge, they say, to try and help them push back Russian forces all along this region. But of course, the complaint, if you can call it a complaint, is that they want more of this. They want more weapons like this, and they want even longer range rocket systems, which they've already been promised, of course, by the United States to push back the Russians even further.
And Ukrainian authorities are likely to need more guns still to hold them back. With no end to this conflict, the demand for US weapons maybe endless too.
That's a perspective we just haven't seen. And Matthew joins me now from Kryvyi Rih in southern Ukraine. Matthew, what is Ukrainian leadership saying about these weapons from the U.S.?
Oh, well, first of all, John, they're saying that they're very grateful indeed for them because they're making a difference on the battlefield. But they're saying they want more of them and they want more frequent deliveries because the supplies of them are becoming depleted, so they can use these weapons to push Russian forces out of Ukrainian cities and help save Ukrainian lives and defend the country, John.
What's President Zelensky been saying about the latest fighting in the east, particularly in the city of Severodonetsk?
Well, it's very grave. He's saying the situation is very difficult. The battle is very ferocious. And he's also making the point that the fate of Donbass, that area in eastern Ukraine, which Russia says is a military priority for it to conquer, the fate of Donbass is being decided in this battle. This, as Russian forces are poised to take over, essentially, the last remaining big city in the Luhansk region of Donbass, which is still nominally, at least at this stage, still under Ukrainian government control.
That would be a significant development there. Matthew Chance, terrific reporting. Thank you very much. Coming up, new details in the search for the woman suspected of killing an elite cyclist in what investigators believe was a deadly act of romantic jealousy. 360's Randy Kay has the latest next. The saga continues tonight in a possible love triangle-turned-murder case. The search for Caitlin Armstrong, the woman accused of killing pro-cyclist Anna Mariah Wilson, is ongoing. Armstrong vanished weeks ago, and tonight we have new details on where she was last seen. Our Randy Kay has the story.
If Caitlin is out there watching, or anyone that is helping her, you know, we ask you to come forward.
A message from the U.S. Marshals to Caitlin Marie Armstrong, who investigators say fled Austin, Texas after gunning down Anna Mariah Wilson, a 25-year-old pro cyclist, on May 11th. Take a good look at these security camera images from May 14th, just a few days after the murder. Federal investigators say that's Armstrong at the airport in Austin, Texas, just before flying to New York City's LaGuardia Airport. And now they say someone dropped her off at Newark Airport in New Jersey 4 days later, on May 18th. As of now, investigators say there is no evidence she took an outbound flight from Newark, or at least not in her real name. All of this puts Caitlin Armstrong hundreds of miles away from the crime scene, and investigators are stumped.
We kind of lost the track, lost the footprint in the sand once she landed there at LaGuardia Airport.
Armstrong's father told ABC his daughter is innocent.
I know that she did not do this. There are a lot of unanswered questions.
Authorities believe Armstrong has the answers to those questions. The motive for the killing may be a jealous rage. The affidavit says both women had been in a romantic relationship with the same man, another professional cyclist named Colin Strickland. An anonymous tip to police said Armstrong made prior statements expressing a desire to kill Wilson. On the day of her murder, the affidavit says Wilson and Strickland spent the afternoon swimming together, then had dinner. After that, Strickland told investigators he dropped Wilson off at her friend's home and did not go inside. Later that night, Wilson's friend returned home to find her bleeding and unconscious in the bathroom. Per the affidavit, she suffered from multiple gunshot wounds. Investigators zeroed in on Armstrong as a suspect after obtaining video surveillance that shows an SUV similar to Armstrong's near the crime scene just 1 minute after Wilson went inside. That's according to the police affidavit, which also says ballistic evidence recovered at the scene is similar to bullets test fired from a Sig Sauer handgun belonging to Armstrong.
We'd like to safely bring you into custody so that, you have your day in court and you'll be able to tell your side of the story.
But Armstrong had her chance to tell her side of the story once already. Before skipping town, investigators picked her up on an outstanding arrest warrant unrelated to this case and questioned her about why her vehicle was captured on security camera footage near the murder scene. At the time, they didn't have probable cause to hold Armstrong and let her go, even after they say she offered no explanation for her vehicle's whereabouts.
If she thought or she knew she was going to be wanted for this, she probably had a 5-day head start.
And Randy joins me now from Dallas. Randy, I know you spoke with the U.S. Marshals Service today. What else were they able to share with you?
John, I spoke with Deputy U.S. Marshal Brandon Filla, and he told me that they are still trying to figure out who dropped Caitlin Armstrong at Newark Airport. He said that this was not some sort of mass transit drop. This was a private vehicle, so they're still trying to figure that out. And of course, they've searched the database. Nobody with her name shows up in any sort of outbound flight from Newark. So they're trying to figure out if possibly she was traveling using a fake ID or maybe just using the airport to throw investigators off her trail and possibly left the airport on foot or by some other means. They are poring over all the security camera video, both inside and outside the airport, trying to see if maybe they can spot her possibly even wearing a disguise at the airport, John. Right now, the reward is up to $5,000. They've received more than 70 tips, but still no confirmed sightings of Caitlin Armstrong, John.
Look at that video. Randy Kaye, thank you very much. Next, putting tomorrow's first session of televised January 6th hearings in perspective. Anyone old enough to remember the Iran-Contra hearings in the late 1980s or watch the Watergate hearings, anyone familiar with either of these knows that these rare proceedings often produce surprises and drama, and more often than not, a better approximation of the truth of what really happened than anyone might have expected. Will that be the case with the January 6th hearings, which get underway tomorrow night? It will certainly be something to watch for. CNN's special coverage begins tomorrow night at 7 o'clock Eastern Time right here on CNN. The news continues, so let's hand it over to Laura Coates and CNN Tonight.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.